Quick note, this episode contains graphic descriptions of animal deaths.
So there's this kind of cycle where every summer, pictures appear in tabloids around the world of the sea turning red, of rows of slaughtered whales, of children being present in these kind of very bloody scenes. Lots of things that people find very shocking. And the emotions run very, very high on both sides.
And that was Tamsin Blackster, researcher and writer at Table. Before joining Table to explore the values and evidence behind different food system debates, Tamsin was a linguist.
This practice is called Grindetrop. The vowel in the second syllable, if you want the linguistics description, is a diphthong of a rounded open mid-back vowel followed by a unrounded vowel of the same height and backness. So something like or followed by a, but it's quite short, so it's like drop.
Tamsin Blackster is talking here about how to pronounce Grindetrop, a whaling practice unique to the Faroese Islands. We asked her to describe the method or technique of Grindetrop.
Well, actually, so I will also introduce the etymology in answer to that question. So a grind is a pod of whales. Drop is just the word for slaughter. So this is killing not whales, but pods of whales. And the way it's done is they spot pods and they use boats to drive them into a bay. And once they've been driven up a long, narrow bay, which gets shallower very gradually, they can force one of the whales to beach itself, and that would traditionally have been done by spearing it at the right angle, but nowadays that's not necessarily how it works. And the others then, because they're very social species, they don't abandon members of the pod, so you can then force them all to beach themselves. And then they're slaughtered on the beach, traditionally using, I guess, machete-type knives, nowadays using a device called a menistingari, which is translated as spinal lance. So it's kind of like a, if you can imagine a little lance with a little arrowhead that is plunged into the animal's neck just behind the head to sever the spine. So they're killed very quickly when they're killed.
So why are we talking about a Faroese whaling practice? Tamsin Blackster recently wrote a blog for Table on the subject. And why did she recently write this blog?
This is a part of the world that I've been interested in for a while, so I'm a bit familiar with this landscape and the languages and the history. But as an animal ethics and food contest that's played out very much in public in big letters in newspapers every year, it really interested me because, like, most of the arguments here about the importance of food traditions and history, like what is sentience, what kind of cruelty is acceptable, the health implications of eating different kinds of meat, all of these are arguments that you can find about eating other kinds of meat or meat from other kinds of sources, or at least they're close analogues of all these arguments in most such debates. But the people making the arguments are quite different, and the media dynamics of this are quite different, and maybe the particular identities, the identity issues at play are a bit different. And I think that makes it really a good case study to help us think about some of these issues. It's also just a really interesting case study from the point of view of what is sustainability and what might a really different future food system look like.
Welcome to Feed, a food systems podcast presented by Table. I'm Samara Brock.
And I'm Matthew Kessler. And today we parse Grindetrop. We ask, what places whaling have in a sustainable food future? What's different about whaling compared to the morality of killing farmed animals? What role does power play in this debate? And in this incredibly charged conversation, should we be paying attention to something else beyond the polarizing media headlines?
First off, can you locate us? Where are we geographically?
The Faroes are an archipelago in the North Atlantic. So if you're used to the geography of the UK, Scotland, you go up, you find Orkney, you go further up, you find the Shetland Isles, and you go further up still and you find the Faroes. They are legally self-governing, but also partially under the Danish crown. And so they historically were part of Norway and then part of Denmark.
Can you tell us the two different stories of Grindetrop? So
there are those who talk about it from the perspective of those who are engaged in the hunt, and then there's those who are more anti it, and perhaps like the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society.
So I'll start with Sea Shepherd, and they're not the only conservation group that opposes this, but they are by far the most prominent one. So I think they would say something like, in order to survive on these islands, it was necessary for people to do relatively terrible things to cause these very intelligent, very social, sentient, big animals an immense amount of pain and suffering, kill them in this very inhumane way, in order for human beings to survive. But modern technologies then have removed that necessity. You can survive on these islands without doing this anymore. And at the same time, modern technologies created a whaling industry, which decimated the populations of many other cetaceans around the world. And that led to the moratorium, which is kind of the international recognition that this wasn't moral. I think they would also say that those modern technologies, some of them have found their way into Grindadrop as well. And that the whales, in some sense, don't have a chance now. This isn't fair traditional hunting, where it's a real contest. This is now something more unjust or ignoble.
While Sea Shepherd argues that this degree of animal suffering is necessary, the other side tells a very different story.
This is a tradition that goes back as long as people have lived on the Faroe Islands, and it kept the ancestors of the current Faroese people alive through hard times. And it also kind of defined them as a distinct culture. So it's a really big, important part of the identity of this culture. Also, all eating meat involves causing pain, involves blood, involves things that might be shocking to modern audiences. But the only difference between Grindadrop and farmed meat is that that happens in secret, in private, away from public view in the case of farmed animals, and it happens out in public with Grindadrop. But at the end of the day, these cetaceans, these whales, dolphins, are animals that have lived full natural wild lives, not meaningless lives in cages. So if you don't romanticize whales, this seems actually morally better than getting meat in other ways. I think that would be the argument for it, the story that we might tell. But incidentally, these are actually dolphins, not whales. They're called pilot whales, but strictly speaking, they're a kind of dolphin. It's the main species that's taken.
When we talk about different actors advocating for different futures, part of that comes with how do we understand the past, and either a romanticization of the past or using the past as an example of what we should do or we shouldn't do. And sometimes traditions aren't that long. They're actually invented. So I'm curious, can you talk a little bit about the history of Grindadrop? How far back does it go?
Yeah, so that's a little bit contested in itself. If you were to read uncritically the Faroese government's writings on this, or the kind of whaling groups, you would get the sense that this form of whaling has been carried out in this way ever since the Faroes were settled, at least were settled by Nordic speakers, so maybe 1200 years. I think if you ask like historians, the evidence, it's generally agreed the evidence doesn't really bear that out. We do know that people have been eating whales in the Faroes since they were settled, as indeed they were in pretty much all the communities around North Atlantic, North Sea. But this particular practice of driving pods of whales, this method of hunting, our first records of that are like the 16th century. And we actually have pretty good records from the 16th century onwards of catch levels and that kind of thing. And there's a suggestion that it may have developed as a response to economic pressures that made the previous means of subsistence on the Faroes less viable around the 15th century. So, yeah, whether you think that a 500-year-old tradition is old or recently invented, I guess depends on the scale that you normally consider your history in. Like many such things, it is both old and also constantly changing. It is also both old and not as old as it's claimed to be.
Tamsin points out that the practice of Grindadrop in the Faroese is distinct from other types of whaling. There was an earlier subsistence culture whaling in coastal communities, and it's also followed a different trajectory than the commercial whaling industry, which is led by Norway, the USSR, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States.
That was a big increase with new technologies in commercial whaling in the first half of the 19th century for oil. They hunted the populations of whales not to extinction, but to commercial extinction, to the point where it was no longer commercially viable. Then in the latter part of the 19th century, so the 1880s, we start getting new technologies for whaling being invented in Norway. So I'm thinking here things like explosively propelled harpoons, explosive harpoons, much faster ships. And that enabled them to start targeting populations of whales that had previously been too fast to use with traditional like rowing boat-based whaling techniques. From that point onwards, whaling increased pretty much continuously during the 20th century. That peaked in 1964, and then the moratorium was finally brought in the early 80s, 82. So we're talking about, like, I think the height was something like 80,000 whales taken a year, and maybe 2.9 million whales taken over the 20th century. So that's the context. Faroese whaling, Grindadrop, has had peaks and troughs. There was a peak in the 60s, there was a peak in the 80s, and it's come down since then. But the peak was like 2,500 a year. The steady level, it's been between 500 and 1,000 a year, basically ever since. Those are pretty consistent numbers if you look at past centuries. And these are species that aren't commercially hunted.
So you talked about the historical, cultural reasons, the arguments for pro carrying on this tradition, and then also touched a little bit on ethical considerations. What are some of the other criticisms and defenses of this practice?
The people who oppose this practice, I think, from the outside, most often cite animal ethics questions around the experience of the whales, like what kind of animals are these? Are these special animals in terms of their level of sentience, their level of sociality, how kind of sophisticated and complex these animals are that should mean we shouldn't kill them? There are criticisms of the manner of slaughter, that it's slow, that it involves these animals swimming around in their relatives' blood for hours, potentially in really slow, difficult hunts, involves witnessing their relatives' deaths. It's also criticized, as I said, on the basis that the food is unneeded, but then further from that, that it's demonstrably wasted. So it's not generally sold, it's generally distributed. By law, it can't be sold and must be distributed by a formula to the local population. If you compare the figures, I mean, this is really hard to do because the research isn't really there, but the conservation groups make the argument that if you compare the figures of what the amounts of meat that people report that they eat and the amounts that are being taken and distributed, about 2/3 of it must be thrown away. It's also because of heavy metal concentrations, because of pollution, it's now not safe for human consumption. So those are all arguments that are made against it.
Tanzan continued to cite arguments against this practice from within the Faroese community.
Then from within, I think there was a big argument that this is like harming the international reputation of the Faroes. This gives them a bad name. And that particularly comes from the tourist industry, but also from the aquaculture industry, which is really growing very fast on the Faroes. Then I think the arguments in favor of it, I've already said the catch has been pretty similar for centuries. It's probably 1% of the population of pilot whales, so that suggests that it should be sustainable. I think a lot of the defenses of it might take the form of criticisms of the alternatives. So the alternative is more reliance on imported food, and that's not sustainable either for totally different reasons. That's not sustainable because it relies on fossil fuels, makes the Faroes not a self-sustaining community. It also alienates people from the way their food is created and where it comes from, whereas Grindadrop is a very, very different kind of way of relating to food and subsistence. Places food outside of commerce. It makes obtaining food a community event that everyone comes together for. It makes it meaningful. And then I think also there is definitely an argument among people who practice this that basically people romanticize whales, but these are like cows. And if you're okay with slaughtering cows, there's no reason you shouldn't be okay with slaughtering these animals. Those, I think, are the substantive arguments that are made in favor of it. And then there's also a sense that the criticism is unfair. That it's cultural imperialism, these outsiders coming and telling us how we can live our lives and the our traditions, but that's not acceptable.
So you've been talking about these pros and cons and sort of this, I mean, for lack of better framing, like rational, measured way. But from what you're describing, I imagine people must get very emotionally charged about this issue. Can you talk a little bit about that, the emotions you've experienced in doing this research?
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to talk as an outside person trying to write about this. It's quite difficult to get to talk to the people who actually carry this out, and I haven't managed to speak to them, but I've read all of what people have written, and I've talked to people around it, and I've talked to people campaigning against it. And yeah, the emotions are very, very high on both sides. So for the last few years, since the Faroese government took the step of basically progressively banning the anti-whaling ships from Faroese waters, the main strategy that have been used by those campaigning against this practice has been to take photos of it and send them to the press around the world. And so there's this kind of cycle where every summer, pictures appear in tabloids around the world of the sea turning red, of rows of slaughtered whales, of children being present in these kind of very bloody scenes. Lots of things that people find very shocking. You can find endless newspaper articles that describe this as barbaric, as primitive, as cruel, that describe the people doing this in those sorts of terms. And then you can find Facebook groups with, you know, membership larger than the population of the Faroes by really considerable degree, exchanging comments in much more flowery language than just barbaric and cruel about how awful the people who do this must be. And it has to be said that some of the conservation groups that oppose it have also engaged in that kind of language in the past. So that's, on the one hand, this is clearly deeply offends the sensibilities, the morals of many people who look on from the outside, and they are not shy to say so. That is felt as equally offensive, a really, really fundamental attack on the cultural identity of the people who carry this out, that this is a real positive community-defining practice that, you know, produces food which everyone remembers eating from their childhood, and that you were really advised to get your kids to eat lots of in the 70s and 80s because it was a really good way to get micronutrients and good source of protein, good source of fat, and that kind of thing. So it's a childhood comforting food that people remember. Yeah, feelings run very, very high on both sides.
As Samara was saying, you're describing everything in a manner that's measured and rational, and having a bit more difficulty reading your own position in this and how it might have evolved over the course of the piece.
So my own position, come to this as someone who doesn't eat meat, doesn't eat animal source foods. My starting point is one of an interest in animal ethics, animal suffering. That's why I first came to the decision to stop eating animal source foods. And before that, my family are vegetarian. So I've come from a like solidly interest in animal rights and therefore not eating these foods point of view. I don't know. I've been trying to work out whether my views have changed over reading about all of this, over talking to people that are involved. In a kind of fundamental way, no, I wouldn't have eaten this beforehand and I wouldn't eat it now. I have been to the Faroes and I did consider, because it's, you know, part of the cultural experience of visiting a different place. And I actually really do respect that as a notion. I care about cultural diversity and variation and there being other perspectives and blah, blah, blah. Like, that all seems really meaningful and important to me. I didn't, when I went to the Faroes, feel like I could square that enough to try eating these things myself. At the end of the day, I don't like personally feel comfortable with the idea of killing these animals in this way or probably any way, but I also don't think it's the right thing to focus on if that's your main goal in sustaining populations of animals in the wild, because I don't think there is very strong evidence that this is a population under threat. Or at least not from this. It might be under threat from heavy metal poisoning and some other things, but probably not from hunting.
So Tanzin doesn't condone the practice of killing animals for her own personal consumption, And she also doesn't find evidence that they're being hunted to extinction or even reduce population levels.
And I do think I've been persuaded that you can really learn something about different ways of relating to food by engaging in an open-minded, interested way with traditional practices like this, even if they might not, in some respects, line up with your own ethical position. I think the Faroes is a really interesting place in terms of food culture, because this isn't the only traditional subsistence practice which is still carried out there. Traditionally, harvesting seabirds' eggs formed a very important part of subsistence. Sheep farming, but like really small scale, small holding of sheep, and various very unusual ways of preserving mutton are really important parts of traditional Faroe subsistence. And those are all actually still practiced to different degrees, in a much more widespread way than like the traditional subsistence practices of, say, like where I grew up in England are still practiced in the population at large. And there's an increasing movement, I understand, towards exploring new methods of like community non-commercial subsistence. And that all, so like vegetable gardening and this kind of thing, and that really reflects a very different community relationship with food, even though the globalized food system is definitely now a huge part of how the Faroes feeds itself. So I think it's really worth engaging with these things in a measured, interested, open-minded way and seeing what we can learn.
It's interesting. Do you think, having researched this, talked to people on either side of the debate, is there learning from other people's perspectives, or is that just not how this is going to unfold? Is this a black and white issue? Is this a binary, or is there some sort of middle ground that people could consider meeting?
I mean, on the one hand, it's a remarkably inflexible tradition in some ways. Like, if you look at the history of commercial whaling, at least on paper, it was possible to come up with regulations like you can't take whales under a certain size, so you have to let them grow to adulthood and have a chance to reproduce before they are subject to hunting. You can't take pregnant females, you can't take nursing females. All those regulations were broken in really widespread ways, which is why in the end the moratorium had to come in. But at least in theory, there were ways that you could try and moderate that practice and come to some kind of middle ground which would make it sustainable. In the case of Grindadrop, because you are legally obligated to report if you spot a pod of whales, and it is then offered to the grind foreman at every bay it passes, as I understand it. So there can't be any centralized means of controlling catch. And the decision is just, do you slaughter the entire pod or none of them? So all of these mechanisms that we use to kind of come up with a theoretical middle ground for managing wild populations, only taking some individuals and so on, aren't really available here. You kill the whole pod or you don't kill any of them.
Tamsin then reflected on ways to have a constructive conversation within this debate.
And the nature of the debate really makes it hard to find anybody speaking in a kind of middle ground, speaking in a balanced way about it. But there are people. The academic I spoke to, Ragnar Bogadottir, who works on this from the point of view of as a sustainable non-commercial subsistence practice in the context of talking about like long-term food systems sustainability and a move away from the globalized food system. Like, that's a really interesting, very different point of view. And the other interesting thing is that the people I spoke to agree that even though the effect of these newspaper articles and the kind of extremely inflamed rhetoric is that everybody gets polarized on both sides, it has also actually caused gradual cultural change.
So what has cultural change looked like?
So it is the case that it's quite age stratified who is interested in this practice. It's quite age stratified who's willing to eat whale and how much whale people eat. Though that's probably also to do with health warnings. So even though this very polarized debate doesn't look like it's going anywhere, the evidence is that long-term the conversation is gradually shifting. So I don't know, that's in a way that's optimistic to me, that maybe it is possible for the community to be gradually having conversations about this, gradually changing its thinking about this, even as the surface conversations that you read don't seem very productive year by year.
Keeping with our theme of exploring power in the food system, has writing this piece made you think about how power operates in this context? Who sort of gets the right to assert an opinion or whose opinion gets heard? How are people on either side of the issue reflecting on whether they have power in this conversation or not?
Yeah. In a way, the way this conversation is carried out, it is all about power. This is the practitioners of Grindrop on the one hand present this as they are members of a small community carrying out their traditional practice, and they are being attacked by enormously more populous, wealthy foreigners from around the world for just living the way they have always lived. So that is very much a story about being an embattled, disempowered minority. On the other hand, I think that Sea Shepherd and other conservation groups like that would highlight that they have no power whatsoever to change the law, that this is all down to the decisions of the Faroese people at the end of the day. All they're doing is journalistic work and reporting what's happening. They would also present it very much in terms of the sentient beings in this with the least power are the pilot whales and the Atlantic white-sided dolphins, which are the two main species taken, who have no power over their environment, which is being made more toxic and more dangerous by the year, have no power over whether they are selected as a pod to be slaughtered or not, have no longer got any chance to escape that they would once have done, because where once this was carried out on rowing boats with spears and ropes, it's now carried out on motorboats. Yeah, so it's absolutely presented as being all about power on both sides. I don't know how helpful any of that framing is. In some ways, it seems to me that the power framing is the really polarized framing of this. And that has made me wonder about how do you know whether framing things in terms of power will illuminate who has power and isn't using it? And when is it just a way of everyone putting up walls about themselves and saying we need to defend ourselves?
Power might just be its own power move.
Exactly. Yeah, power is its own power move.
As you're speaking, I can't help but thinking that people on either side of this debate are very much using framing from sustainable food, from alternative food movements in very different ways. And I'm just wondering if you can talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's exactly how each side would present it, that in some sense we're talking about a kind of hegemonic, oppressive food system that is harming someone, and a different food system as a mode of resistance to it. In a way that, like, hopefully can point towards the way that there are actually shared goals here, and that if the debate takes place in different terms, there are ways that different communities of activists or food system stakeholders can learn from each other. And one thing I'd say is that from speaking to Sea Shepherd, their goal is to try and move this into being a Faroese internal conversation. They hope one day to open a branch in the Faroe Islands, staffed entirely by local people, and pass the campaign entirely to that branch, so that then the conversation can, so it can take at least some of the power arguments out of it and turn it into a conversation about the kind of shared or not shared goals.
In the beginning of our conversation, you identified Grindrop as an interesting case study to explore big questions like, what is animal sentience? Where do older food traditions fit into the present? How does international media coverage impact local debates? And is this a sustainable practice? So after writing this piece, have you found greater clarity on some or any of those questions?
Yeah, so I think one of the things I realized is, like, that we don't know the answer to a lot of these questions, and that our understanding is still developing and is going to keep developing further. So on pilot whale sentience, suffering, social behavior, our understanding of all of those things has improved in the last 5 years. It's improved a lot in the last 10 years. If we think that's relevant to the moral question of whether we should kill these animals, if so, how is it okay to do so? I think we can assume that will keep changing. The methods of killing these animals has changed in the last 20 years towards being quicker and hopefully less cruel, but also in some ways probably crueler. So probably the mode of hunting has become crueler and the mode of killing has become quicker and less cruel. So those are things that are also in flux in really recent time, given the time depth that this tradition has. The health implications of eating this is changing. And then there are a bunch of things that I haven't been able to find good information on. So how sustainable is this? Like, how steady are these populations? The indications are relatively good, but there aren't very good studies. How much of this meat are people eating? I don't think the data is really there to make strong claims about that. So there are all sorts of ways in which I think, like, lots of this is still up in the air. And changing the way we have the conversation could also allow people to study this better and get a better understanding of all of it. Yeah, very tabley conclusion.
Thank you for speaking with us, Tamsin.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for inviting me.
That was Tamsin Blackster, researcher and writer at Table and author of the upcoming publication, Parsing Gringer Drop, which will be published on the Table website next week at the end of June 2022. You can find the full piece, along with thousands of other food system resources, at tabledebates.org. Thank you all for listening. We'd love to hear what you thought of this episode and the podcast. You can support us by leaving comments on our webpage or rating us and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can share your favorite episodes with your friends and colleagues. Table is a collaboration between the University of Oxford, Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences, and Wageningen University. This episode was edited and mixed by Matthew Kessler, music by Blue Dot Sessions, and we'll be back to our conversations with people across the food system, interrogating how they view power and how they think it should change in our upcoming episodes. Happy summer and winter solstice to you all, depending on your hemisphere.